From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
And let's give a welcome to Makaka here. Welcome to America and the real world of Virginia.
Makaka? That's Senator George Allen's word for a young Virginia native of Indian descent. He was a volunteer for Allen's opponent's campaign. Allen's critics say he was using a racist slur by calling him a monkey. Allen says he just made up the word. We'll go to the University of Virginia to speak with the young man at the center of the controversy, S.R. Siddharth. But first to Chicago, where a Mexican woman fighting deportation has taken refuge inside a church with her son. Immigrants' rights activists are rallying to her cause.
She's like our Rosita Parks, and we should all be rallying around her to make sure they don't deport her because it may demoralize the media.
And we'll speak with longtime peace activist Kathy Kelly. She attended a mass funeral in Cana, Lebanon. And we'll talk to a Michigan man who lost over 20 members of his family in the Israeli attack on the city. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Bush admitted Monday the Iraq War is, quote, straining the psyche of our country, but he vowed to stay the course.
Leaving Iraq before the mission is complete will send the wrong message to the enemy and will create a more dangerous world. That's what we're saying.
Monday's press conference was the first one held by President Bush since it was revealed a record 3,500 people had died in Iraq last month. The Lebanese government's accusing Israel of repeatedly violating the nine-day-old ceasefire. On Monday night, Israeli troops in South Lebanon shot and killed three Hezbollah fighters. Italy's agreed to send 3,000 troops to South Lebanon and lead the international force to police the region. But Italy's foreign minister said Italy would only do so if Israel stopped fighting. In Washington, President Bush pledged to give Lebanon $230 million in humanitarian aid. The total aid package is less than 1% of what the United States sends annually to Israel. Meanwhile, the head of Lebanon's central bank, Riyad Salam, criticized Israel for continuing its naval and air blockade.
Although there is a cessation of hostilities, the economy is still regressing because of the blockus that has been put on Lebanon. As long as the airport and the port are not active in a free way, we do not foresee a resumption of growth in the Lebanese economy.
Lebanon's economy minister Sami Haddad said it would be impossible to build a stable democracy if Israel continues to invade Lebanon.
You cannot build a stable democracy and a prosperous economy if you're subjected every 3 or 4 years to a massive and destructive Israeli invasion that destroys your economy.
Lebanese officials have begun studying possible ways to sue Israel and its political and military leaders for war crimes. On Monday, Lebanon's justice minister held a meeting with top Lebanese magistrates and legal experts. The Daily Star of Beirut is reporting a leading Lebanese scientist has discovered a crater caused by an Israeli bomb that contains a high degree of unidentified radioactive materials. The bomb landed in the Lebanese town of Khayyum. It caused a crater 10 feet deep and 30 feet wide. The National Council for Scientific Research is planning to test samples from the site. In Israel, calls are increasing for Prime Minister Ehud Olmert to resign over his handling of the war in Lebanon. On Monday, a group of reservist soldiers protested in Jerusalem. This is Israeli reservist Sonny Katz.
The Prime Minister, the Minister of Defense, and the Chief of Staff of the military should resign because, at the end of the day, soldier went to fight and didn't got proper equipment, and nobody knew what was the bottom line mission that these guys should achieve. And that was politics, and we blame that on the government and the leaders in the army.
Three Palestinians have died in Gaza after Israeli tanks raided the region early this morning. Israel said the dead were all militants. In Britain, 11 people have been charged in connection with an alleged terror plot to blow up transatlantic planes. British police official Peter Clark said evidence has been uncovered linking the suspects to the plot.
I can also tell you that since the 10th of August, we have found bomb-making equipment. There are chemicals, including hydrogen peroxide, electrical components, documents, and other items. We have also found a number of video recordings.
British police are holding 11 other people without charge. Meanwhile, police in Germany have arrested a 21-year-old Lebanese student on charges he plotted to plant bombs on two German trains. The student, Yusuf Mohammed, is reported to have lost a brother in an Israeli airstrike last month in Lebanon. In Florida, a U.S. federal judge has dismissed one of the main charges against Jose Padilla, the man once accused of plotting to set off a dirty bomb. U.S. District Judge Marsha Cook dismissed count one of the indictment, conspiracy to murder, kidnap, and maim persons in a foreign country. She said the allegations in the count were already covered in the indictment. Earlier this month, Judge Cook ordered prosecutors to provide more details to make their case against Padilla and two co-defendants. She said the case against Padilla appears, quote, very light on facts. In Mexico, a group of striking teachers have seized control of 12 commercial radio stations in the state of Oaxaca. Since June, tens of thousands of teachers have been on strike. They've demanded higher wages and the resignation of the governor of Oaxaca. The stations were seized after gunmen attacked another radio and TV station that's been occupied by the demonstrators for weeks. This is Sergio Beltran of Radio Plantón in Oaxaca.
It was almost an instantaneous reaction from the people. At the beginning was one station, the biggest one of the city, that was taken. And because the owners of the stations turned down the transmitter, then people began to move to other stations until around 6:30 in the morning. Today, all the station was taken by the people. The most important tool that this movement has had in their hands is the radio and the TV channel. So it was a reaction to keep the people informed of what is happening minute by minute in the whole state, but especially in the city of Oaxaca.
UN nuclear inspectors said Monday Iran has denied them access to an underground nuclear site. The UN officials said this may be a violation of the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty. In Sri Lanka, Human Rights Watch is calling on both the government and the Tamil Tigers to allow humanitarian aid to reach thousands of civilians trapped by fighting. In North Sri Lanka, about 500,000 residents have been left with dwindling supplies of food and water and no ability to go to safe areas. About 40,000 people are believed to have fled their homes. Meanwhile, here in the United States, police have arrested 13 people on suspicion of conspiring to buy arms for the Tamil Tigers. In news from Africa, Barack Obama is preparing to visit Kenya for the first time since he became a senator. Obama's father was born in Kenya. On Monday, Obama visited South Africa and criticized how the government there is handling the AIDS epidemic. He said he planned to speak about AIDS in Kenya as well.
One of the things when I go to Kenya that I'll be doing is probably getting an AIDS test myself in front of the cameras, just to encourage so that people can see. You know, there's nothing stigmatizing about getting an AIDS test. You know, so a lot of times, I think leading by example can be very helpful, and that's something that I'd like to do.
Meanwhile, 400 extra European Union troops are being flown into the Democratic Republic of Congo. The capital of Kinshasa has seen 3 days of clashes between forces loyal to the two men who are facing each other in a presidential runoff in October. Supporters of Jean-Pierre Bemba have accused President Joseph Kabila's guards of attacking Bemba's house. And in an update in a story we've been following, First Lieutenant Aaron Watada has been charged with 3 offenses for refusing to fight in Iraq. In June, he became the first U.S. military officer to openly oppose the war there. He was charged with conduct unbecoming an officer, missing movement, and contempt toward officials. And in California, legislators have agreed to raise the state minimum wage to $8 an hour. Workers will get a 75-cent increase January 1st, an additional 50 cents on January 1st, 2008. The pay hike will affect more than 1 million Californians who earn the current minimum wage, $6.75 an hour. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In the latest news out of Lebanon, the Israeli army says its troops shot and killed 3 gunmen in the south Monday evening. Hezbollah said none of its men were killed. The latest incident comes despite a UN-brokered ceasefire that ended 34 days of warfare. The fragile truce is in its ninth day, but Israeli troops remain in southern Lebanon. Both sides accuse each other of violations. With the end of the war, residents in southern Lebanon emerge from shelters for a grim task to bury their dead. The largest funeral took place over the weekend in Qana, where an Israeli airstrike on the town on July 30th killed 29 people, the majority of them women and children taking refuge. Although the victims were killed 3 weeks ago, they could not be buried because of Israel's continued aerial bombardment in southern Lebanon. Bodies were taken to a morgue in Tyre and later buried in a shallow mass grave when refrigerated trucks holding the corpses became too crowded. On Friday, the bodies were exhumed and taken to the home villages for burial after residents decided it was finally safe. The attack on Qana made headlines around the world and highlighted the plight of Lebanese civilians in the conflict. More than 1,000 Lebanese were killed in the month-long war, the vast majority civilian. Peace activist Kathy Kelly visited Qana on Saturday and spoke to many survivors and grieving relatives. She's the founder of Voices for Creative Nonviolence and Voices in the Wilderness. She joins us on the phone from Amman, Jordan. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Kathy.
Hello, Amy.
It's good to have you with us. Can you describe your visit to Qana?
Well, Amy, on August 17th, we had with us the list of massacres that Norman Finkelstein had compiled, and we asked two young men who very kindly had offered to drive us through the villages in southern Lebanon and act as translators for 2 days if they might take us to Qana. And we went to the town, and, you know, as soon as you enter, people can point you, and there are signs that point you to the site of a massacre that had taken place in 1996 when 105 people taking refuge in a UN camp had been killed. And then just a very short walk away from that is the place where this latest massacre took place. And as we turned a corner, we realized that we were walking right toward the homes of two of the families who had lost loved ones. And they lived literally right across the road, really not a very wide road at all, from the building that had been hit. So we walked over to the building, and we could see that it was completely demolished. People had taken shelter in the basement of this building. Several children were at play, and they were very friendly toward us. And when we turned around and walked back toward the families, women sitting in mourning, waiting to receive relatives, gestured for us, Farah and me, to come and sit with them, and our male companions went and sat with the men just next door. And I have to say that I'm then at a very great disadvantage because both of the translators were gone, but in a way, there wasn't a lot of translation necessary. We sat in silence for a long time with the women. Unbearable grief for 18 days, they'd borne their grief. Waiting for the time when, as you mentioned, the burials could happen. We had seen the graves being dug when we came into town. And two of the women there had lost their children. One, Zainab, was the mother of Zainab, a six-year-old girl. The other, Zahra, the mother of Zahra. And they wanted us to understand that the children had been running back and forth across from this sheltering building back to their homes for days. And they pointed upwards, and still the drone of the surveillance planes could be heard, and certainly we caught their question, couldn't the Israeli planes see that there were children going in and out of that building?
Kathy, I wanted to play for you the comments of a man here who lost family members in Qana. The victims of the Qana massacre came primarily from two families, the Shaloub and Hashem families, who'd fought refuge in a building in the town. The day after the Israeli airstrike, we spoke with a member of one of those families. He is Mike Shaloub. He runs a restaurant called Grape Leaves in Dearborn, Michigan. He was born in and grew up in Qana. At the time we spoke to him, initial reports had put the death toll from the attack at near 60. He had just returned from visiting family in Qana.
I was with the kids. We were having a vacation there. I go to Qana, we spend a couple of days, then we go back to the mountains. So, you know, we go everywhere in Lebanon to have fun. And then the kids, when I left, they went to Qana because they love it there. All those little kids died. They were used to be their friends. Israel decided to have a war against Lebanon. Actually, I saw those cousins that just went in this tragedy. they were there and haven't seen them in a couple of years, 2-3 years. And we're talking about the old time and, you know, memories really chalked me up when I heard it on the news. Two brothers, they're kind of my age. When I saw them this time, we were talking about what they're doing and how things going with them. And they just told me they have a construction company to open a company like a year ago, and they build houses and they're doing great. And, you know, they're just very peaceful people. Those two brothers alone, they lost their kids too. Each one of them, has 3 kids and one of them has 4 kids. They died with them too, with their wives. Except one of them, wives stayed alive. She made it. And, you know, she had to live her life now looking up pictures for her husband and kids. It's very hurtful. This house wasn't their house. It was a building under construction. And they were both building it for their cousin from their mom's side. And they thought this is a safer place because they have underground area. And their houses is around. It's not like that far. It's not even half blocks away around every one house. But they tried to get together, so this way, if anything happened to anybody, everybody, you know, it's together on this situation. And obviously, that was their last. They don't want it to leave because there was no chance to leave. Telling the people get out, you know, army telling the people to get out, Israel army, I mean. And then they hit them on the road. So when I talked to my brother, he says, he talked to them and he told them to get out of there. And he says, well, they're not trying to get out of there because they're afraid they're going to get hit on the road, like what happened in the city of Dwyer. So they decided to be there, and they thought they would be more safer on that side. And obviously, you know, crazy pilot that he decided to get his revenge on those kids. When I was watching the news, I was shocked. So I kept watching to see where it had and where it hits. So then they said it's, you know, it's a neighborhood of Shalhoub's family. Then I know it's my family, you know. I mean... No other reason not to believe this, because we know this area, it's only us. 90% of the majority there, it's the Shalhoub family. So that shocked me up. I don't know what to do. I turned TV off. I disconnected TV so my parents would not see that. They would not see those kids dying like that. I have to lay it down a little bit at a time for them. I couldn't get through from here. So my brother, I called my brothers and they're talking to them to see what they're doing and how they're doing. He brought some of them to Beirut. We get them down to Beirut area where safe, you know, safe places. There's some places, some areas safe, some areas not safe. And I don't know if any area is going to be safe after this. So all we're asking is for this ceasefire to happen.
Mike Shalhoub, speaking to us from Dearborn, Michigan. He runs a restaurant there called Grape Leaves. He was born in Cana, talking about his time in Cana this summer before the attack that killed many members of his family. Kathy Kelly, you come from Chicago, Voices in the Wilderness. Your response as you just came out of Cana.
Well, I hope that Mike Shalhoub's words and his suffering will be something that people can hold in their hearts. I think very difficult for people in the United States to fully understand the massive, massive tragedy that has befallen people in many small villages, just like the one which he described. You know, the mothers that we sat with sorted through newspapers bearing the pictures of their children and one man holding little Zainab's lifeless body aloft. It took 5 hours for ambulances to get to the site of the massacre. And I think that it's also important to read and study the draft report that Anthony Kordsman has issued, called a preliminary report on lessons of the Israeli-Hezbollah war. And he's a very seasoned military strategist, and he writes that the air campaign continued to escalate against targets that were often completely valid, but that sometimes involved high levels of collateral damage and very uncertain tactical and military effects. Well, those are words that are dispassionate and cool, and I think if he could sit with these parents who've lost their children, if he could go and visit Mr. Shalhoub in his restaurant and understand what collateral damage means and understand how for generations people will remember what has happened. And this doesn't mean that there's any justification for a mortar fired by Hezbollah that kills a child in Haifa, but the disproportionate and overwhelming capacity of the Israelis to kill civilians, to maim people, to destroy their infrastructure, this has been supported directly by United States people. Just under the Bush administration, $9.4 billion went to help build up the Israeli Defense Force and the Israeli Air Force. And when Mike Shalhoub talks about a couple of crazy guys who just decided to take revenge, I mean, I think people in southern Lebanon will be asking, did the Israeli people really want to continue to escalate this warfare? And this will certainly have ongoing repercussions, and I would imagine that in that area, Hassan Nasrallah virtually has no competitors in terms of his ability to win over people that would say, well, where else are we going to get protection? In fact, right now, we saw no signs of significant aid along the line of food or medicine or water, clean water, and I hope that that situation has radically changed by now. But of course, when the roads and the bridges are destroyed, how can that kind of desperately needed aid come through? But I think that it's most likely Hezbollah's people who will now become aid workers in the region.
Kathy Kelly, there is a memorial in Dearborn, Michigan, to the attack in Qana, not this one, 1996, 10 years ago. And we understand in Qana there are road signs to the current, the attack that just took place, and the one that took place 10 years ago when the Israeli military attacked a UN refugee base and killed scores of Lebanese. Do people talk about that today?
Well, one woman had remarked, this is our curse. I think that there are assuredly many, many people who do not find themselves in these small villages deeply involved in political questions between opposing forces. They're trying to live and raise their children. And in each of the homes that we visited in surrounding villages, we talked with people who were very simple people, somebody harvesting a tobacco crop, a person who was just really using the village of Sirachin as a summer home, as Mr. Shalhoub said, where people like to go and play. But these places have been viciously, savagely attacked.
Kathy Kelly, I want to thank you for being with us, speaking to us from Amman, Jordan, just back from Qana. Kathy Kelly has been nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize several times. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. When we come back, we go to Chicago, where a mother with her child is taking refuge in a church so that she's not deported to Mexico. Stay with us. Thank you. Rahim El-Haj, Sunset of the City, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. On Monday, President Bush admitted the Iraq War is, quote, straining the psyche of our country, but he vowed to stay the course. A reporter questioned him about why he opposed withdrawing U.S. troops from Iraq.
A lot of the consequences you mentioned for pulling out seem like maybe they never would have been there if we hadn't gone in. How do you square all of that?
I square it because... Imagine a world in which you had Saddam Hussein, who had the capacity to make a weapon of mass destruction, who was paying suiciders to kill innocent life, who had relations with Zarqawi. Imagine what the world would be like with him in power. The idea is to try to help change the Middle East. Now, look, part of the reason we went into Iraq was... The main reason we went into Iraq at the time was we thought he had weapons of mass destruction. It turns out he didn't, but he had the capacity to make weapons of mass destruction. But I also talked about the human suffering in Iraq, and I also talked the need to advance a freedom agenda. And so my answer to your question is that imagine a world in which Saddam Hussein was there, stirring up even more trouble in a part of the world that had so much resentment and so much hatred that people came and killed 3,000 of our citizens. You know, I've heard this theory about, you know, everything was just fine until we arrived, and then, you know, kind of the stir up the hornet's nest theory. It just doesn't hold water as far as I'm concerned. The terrorists attacked us and killed 3,000 of our citizens before we started the freedom agenda in the Middle East. What did Iraq have to do with what?
The attack on the World Trade Center.
Nothing, except for it's part of, and nobody's ever suggested in this administration that Saddam Hussein ordered the attack. Iraq was the lesson of September 11th is take threats before they fully materialize, Ken. Nobody's ever suggested that the attacks of September the 11th were ordered by Iraq.
President Bush at his news conference yesterday. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. As we turn now to Chicago, where a battle for immigrant rights is gaining national attention. A Mexican woman has taken refuge inside a Chicago church in an attempt to defy a government deportation order. Elvira Arellano has been living in the Adalberto United Methodist Church since last Tuesday, the day she was supposed to surrender to authorities. She's president of United Latino Family, a group that lobbies for families that could be split by deportation. She was born in Mexico and came to this country as an undocumented immigrant. Her 7-year-old son, Saul, was born in the United States. He's a U.S. citizen. A rally was held Sunday in Chicago to support Elvira. One of those rallying to her cause is immigrants' rights activist Emma Lozano of Puebla Sin Fronteras.
The deportation of Elvira Arellano is, to me, it's just retaliation for all her leadership that she's been at. She's been at the head of the movement. She's been like the Rosa Parks of the undocumented, of the movement for legalization. She's calling for the moratorium. She did the hunger strike for 22 days. She's like our Rosita Parks, and we should all be rallying around her to make sure they don't deport her because it may demoralize the movement.
U.S. Immigrations and Customs Enforcement officials have said Arellano is now considered a fugitive. ICE spokesperson Tim Count said, quote, "We will take action at the time and place of our choosing." Elvira Arellano joins us now on the phone from the church where she has taken refuge with her son. Joining us in a studio in Chicago is Reverend Walter Coleman. He's the pastor at the Adalberto United Methodist Church. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Elvira, can you talk about why you are in the church right now, and is your son with you?
Hi, good morning. I'm stay here. I'm deported and August 15th, and I'm stay here with my son.
And why have you chosen to stay in the church?
I don't know. I'm stay here maybe 1 or 2 weeks more. I don't know. Depending the immigration, maybe they hear me.
Why are you there?
Because the immigration deport me to Mexico.
And why are they saying they will deport you? Elvira.
Hello, good morning.
Hi, this is Amy Goodman from Democracy Now!
Yeah, I'm going to translate for her.
Very good, thank you.
You're welcome, ma'am. I put you on the speakerphone.
Very good. I'm asking Elvira why the government is saying they want to deport her and why she wants to stay in this country with her son.
El gobierno te quiere deportar y porque quiere estar con tu hijo.
Porque él es un ciudadano americano y yo quiero que se respeten sus derechos constitucionales.
Because he is a U.S. citizen and she wants for him to, she wants for them to respect his constitutional rights.
Are you afraid that they will enter the church?
Tú tienes miedo que entren en la iglesia. Yes.
How have you prepared for this?
¿Cómo te has preparado para esto?
Es como solo sé que tengo que estar con mi hijo.
I just know that I have to be with my son.
We're also joined in a Chicago studio by Reverend Walter Coleman, the pastor at the church where Elvira has taken refuge, the Adalberto United Methodist Church. Can you talk about your decision to make your church a sanctuary church, Reverend Coleman?
Certainly, and good morning. First of all, Elvira Arellano is a member of our church and has been a member of our church for 3 years. As we approached the final hours, and it seems that other options were being exhausted, she had decisions, as she could have any time over the last 3 years when she was first arrested and when she was working at the airport for being undocumented. She could have gone and just disappeared like 12 million other people. She could have accepted the deportation, but she has also always said that she would fight what she considers to be an unjust law so that her son will know that he's a child of God, not a piece of junk that can be thrown away. So the option of sanctuary, when she requested it, seemed like a good option to give her holy space to continue a campaign of civil disobedience against an unfair law that is separating families throughout this country.
I'm just going through the list of politicians who are supporting Elvira. You have Congressmember, you have Senator Barack Obama, Congressmember Luis Gutierrez, even Mayor Richard Daley. Can you talk about the congressional action on this issue, Reverend Walter Coleman?
Right there. Because of her leadership, really two private bills have been put in Congress on her behalf, one by Congressman Gutierrez and another by Congressman Bobby Rush. Congressman Rush's bill includes a group of other families that Elvira actually organized who are all in the same situation. That is, one or other of the parents is undocumented and facing deportation for doing nothing wrong except entering this country and working and paying taxes. But their children are U.S. citizens. And Elvira's worked very hard to dramatize this issue. She's led delegations to Washington, large delegations of 100, 150, seven times in the last year, talked to over 120 congressmen and over 40 senators. She's won the support at the Chicago City Council and the mayor, the Cook County Board, and the Cook County President, the state legislature, the state Senate have all passed formal resolutions, and the governor of Illinois is supporting her, as well as a wealth of other church and community leaders. And I think, obviously, she has her own particular situation with her son, who she loves and who has a right and a need to stay here with his doctors and in his school. But also, she said that she's fighting a fight of principle. And because of that, I think that she's won support throughout the state and really throughout the country.
Ovida Arellano, can you tell us what Saul is suffering from, your son, why he needs medical attention? We're talking to Ovida in the church where she has taken refuge.
Yo lo que quiero es también porque que él se ha evaluado. Cuando yo fui arrestada, también él entró en pánico porque los oficiales federales llegaron a la casa con armas y él se asustó y él tiene un gran miedo que puedan arrestarme nuevamente.
Because my son has HDAD, and because federal agents, when they entered the house, they came with weapons when they raided the house and Hispanic my son.
How is he getting help in the church right now? Is he getting help?
Sí, él ahorita no ha ido al doctor.
He hasn't gone to the doctor yet.
Pero él en una emergencia puede, hay alguien que su babysitter que lo puede llevar.
But in case of an emergency, his babysitter will bring it to the doctor.
There are conflicting reports of what ICE will do, the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement. The Chicago Tribune has an AP piece that says they would apprehend Arellano at a time and place of their choosing and that nothing prevented them from going into the church. But on Friday, a government official close to the case said immigration agents have decided against entering the church to remove Arellano. The official who spoke on condition of anonymity because it's against ICE policy to discuss operational matters, said the Arellano case carries no more priority than any of the other 500,000 fugitives nationally. Reverend Walter Coleman, what about that? How Elvira's case fits into the national picture? Chicago is a major center of immigrants' rights activism, had perhaps the largest immigrants' right, the first large immigrants' rights protest in the wave of protests we saw in the last months.
Well, I think we have to understand the situation generally. It's very hard for me to read the mind of people in immigration, but generally we have this situation. The President of the United States and the Senate have both said that they would like a program that legalizes at least a large part of those who are in this country. The president has spoken out against the separation of families and mothers and children like Elvira's family. At the same time, under pressure from House Republican leadership, the U.S. government is doubling and tripling its efforts to deport, arrest, to raid factories, and to impose sanctions on employers. We think that this is a contradiction, and part of why we think they're retaliating against Elvira is that she's been so successful in her call for a moratorium on deportations until they fix the law. It's a contradiction to be deporting and arresting and traumatizing children and torturing children of those who may in a few months or a year be able to legalize. We have a broken law. Everybody recognizes that. So we're in a very contradictory situation. And when it comes down to the situation locally, There are a lot of people that that they could go after. There are millions. There are many that they've already written orders for deportation who haven't shown up, who are going on living their lives. They have a lot of choices. They're running around like a bull in a china shop. When a lot of light is shown, as it has on Alvira's case, I think we pray that they'll respect the church and the family and the faith. But obviously, they're looking at public opinion and fighting really a political battle, which unfortunately families and children, are the victims of. So we really don't know if they'll choose. The political winds will grow and they'll choose to disrespect the church and come to get her, or if they'll do as their latest spokesperson has said, that that they'll respect the sanctuary of the church.
Reverend Walter Coleman, are you concerned you will face consequences, sanctions, for your church being used as a sanctuary? And do you see yourself in the tradition of the sanctuary movement of 20 years ago, where churches in this country, and especially along the border from Mexico, gave refuge to refugees from political persecution from Guatemala, from Honduras, from El Salvador?
Right. The sanctuary movement and the sanctuary tradition in the church goes a long way further back than 20 years ago. And certainly we call upon that tradition. That is, that there's holy ground and that there's space that should be respected by governments for those who appeal to the law of God in their acts of conscience and in their seeking of safety from oppression. And we don't really know what they'll look at. They've said that we're liable, and that I'm liable for harboring a fugitive. Elvira Arellano is obviously not a fugitive. She formally told them where she is. She told the world, and everybody in the world knows where she is, her address and phone number and place. She's committing an act of civil disobedience to protect the rights of her child and to bring forth the issue of the cruel separation of families. If they choose to take whatever action they're going to take, I have no control of that, but I fear God much more than I fear Homeland Security.
Finally, let's turn back to Elvira Arellano in the church with her son at the Adalberto United Methodist Church, a storefront church in Chicago. Do you plan to stay at the church indefinitely? How long do you plan to stay?
Indefinidamente, o por cuánto tiempo?
No sé, lo único que yo espero es que pueda quedarme aquí con mi hijo y pueda salir con él para seguir llevándolo a escuela y poder compartir con él afuera. Y yo lo único que estoy buscando es que el gobierno no mira el sufrimiento de mi hijo, no mira que él sufre y que él quiere estar con su mamá. ¿Qué madre no haría lo mismo que yo, defender a su hijo y poder estar con él? Y es lo único que yo quiero, estar con él y seguir trabajando, porque yo siempre he trabajado. Yo no he recibido ninguna ayuda del gobierno para mi hijo. Yo siempre he trabajado para mantenerlo a él y para pagar el cuidado de él cuando yo tengo que trabajar. Y lo único que quiero es seguir haciendo eso, trabajar para él y que él tenga una buena educación, y solo quiero estar con él.
The only thing that I want is to stay with my son. I would like for this to come up good, because I wanted to take my son to school. I want him to have a
work.
I'm working for him. I have worked for him all my life, and I still want to keep working for him all my life. That's what I want.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for being with us, Reverend Walker Coleman, pastor at the Adalberto United Methodist Church, and Elvira Arellano, undocumented immigrant taking refuge in the Adalberto Church and we will continue to follow this story. She is head of United Latino Family. Her son suffers from attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, and she continues to seek medical help for him. He is a U.S. citizen. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We go now to Virginia. Stay with us.
But I'm not crawl on my belly like a reptile. Jano, I'll walk, I'll talk, but I'm not crawl on my belly like a reptile. Going to Miami via Vancouver, coming from Jamaica. Bang, ding, dong, ding, ding, ding. I was on the outside for some reason, they won't let me enter. I went to the border, they say my passport was not in order. And so, 7 of us got back on the bus, felt like a loser. We rent some rooms, we got some food, I'm high a dreamer. I went to some club, they were playing reggae rap and blues. I know I'm a winner, but this time they say I'm a loser. But I say, hey, but I say, hey, hey.
Border Patrol by Ika Mouse here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Well, all eyes are on the Virginia Senate race that pits Republican incumbent George Allen against Democratic challenger Jim Webb. The race was catapulted into the spotlight last week after controversial remarks made by Senator Allen at a campaign rally. Before a mostly white audience at Breaks Interstate Park in far southwest Virginia. During his speech, Allen singled out a volunteer for his opponent's campaign who was taping the event.
Friends, we're going to run this campaign on positive, constructive ideas. And it's important that we motivate and inspire people for something. This fellow here over here with the yellow shirt, Makaka, or whatever his name is, he's with my opponent. He's following us around everywhere. And it's just great. We're going to places all over Virginia. And he's having it on film, and it's great to have you here. And you show it to your opponent because he's never been there and probably will never come. So it's good for you. Rather than living inside the Beltway, or his opponent actually right now is with a bunch of Hollywood movie moguls. We care about fact, not fiction. So welcome. Let's give a welcome to Makaka here. Welcome to America and the real world of Virginia. My friends.
The man Senator George Allen was referring to is S.R. Siddharth. He's 20 years old, a volunteer for Jim Webb's campaign. He was born in Fairfax County, Virginia, and is of Indian descent. The term macaca refers to a genus of monkey and is used as an ethnic slur in some cultures. Webb's campaign soon posted the embarrassing clip on YouTube.com, producing a string of front-page stories. Allen said afterwards he'd meant no insult, that he was sorry if he hurt anyone's feelings, that he didn't know what macaca meant. Allen's aides then said it was a play on the word mohawk for Siddharth's partly shaved head. Webb's campaign was skeptical of the explanations, with his communications director saying, quote, I think it's reaching at best. Regardless, many political analysts say the controversy has affected the Virginia race, with Allen dropping in the polls. The incidents also brought what some call Allen's history of racial and ethnic insensitivity into the fold. We'll discuss that in a minute, but first, the man at the center of the controversy joins us, S.R. Siddharth, a senior at the University of Virginia, volunteer for the James Webb campaign. We welcome you to Democracy Now!
Thanks, Amy. How
it's
are you?
It's good to have you with us. Explain what happened.
Well, I was working for Mr. Webb's campaign, and I had been following Senator Allen for all of the previous week, which is 2 weeks ago now, and this sort of came up out of the blue on Friday evening. I had been following him around since Monday, and nothing of this sort had happened. At any point, he had not talked to me directly during any of these stump speeches that he was giving. And then just Friday evening, this incident occurred, which you just played back.
Now, you had introduced yourself to him.
That's correct. On Monday, when I had started out.
And what do you mean? You went up to Senator Allen and you said who you were?
Yeah, he was just greeting people at the second stop he made on the tour. And he saw me, he shook my hand, asked what my name was. I told him I was Siddharth. And he asked what company I was with, because at that point he thought I might be with some business. And I told him, I'm following you around. So by that point, he had some idea that I was the tracker from Mr. Webb's campaign.
What were your thoughts as he made the comments? Were you filming as he was speaking?
Correct. And it was pretty early in the speech, so as you might see from the video, I was sort of just focusing the camera appropriately. And on the whole, I was pretty humiliated by what he had said and somewhat appalled that someone like a senator of the United States would say that.
What about his explanations that he had made up the word?
Well, if you look at some of the press releases the Allen campaign has been releasing, the first time they said the staffers were the ones who made up the nickname. Then in his quote-unquote apology, because he hasn't made one personally to me, and I would think if he singled me out in a crowd, he would be, you know, it would be his obligation to make an apology to me in person, whether on the phone or otherwise. He said in that statement that it was he who had made the nickname up. So honestly, I'm not sure what to believe.
There have been a lot of postings about this, articles and blogs. One of them I'm looking at, which says, George Allen stepped in Macaca. Pop quiz, which one of these two people was born and raised in Virginia? And there's a photograph of George Allen and of you. And it says, that's right, it's not our elected official who was born in Whittier, California. It's Siddharth, who Allen referred to as Macaca or whatever his name is. The senator then went on to say, welcome to America. Perhaps realizing that he had crossed a line, Allen added, and the real world of Virginia. Kind of funny, since Siddharth has apparently lived nowhere else, that blog said. Your response?
No, I mean, that's right. I think it's ironic that he said that, aside from just being hurtful as a sort of reference that he was making to immigrants in general, when in fact I've lived in Fairfax County my entire life.
S.R. Siddharth, we're also joined by Mark Potok, director of the Intelligence Project for the Southern Poverty Law Center. Can you talk about Senator Allen's record, Mark Potok?
Well, sure. I mean, essentially, it's a 25-year record of flirting with these sort of Confederate ideas. Well, really not sort of. I mean, you know, one of the highlights, at least in my mind, is when he was running for governor in 93, or actually shortly after he was elected, and designated, you know, Confederate History Month in Virginia. And the statement, I think, was quite amazing, the actual words that went with the declaration, in which he described the Civil War as, quote, a struggle for independence and sovereign rights. You know, I think that kind of captures the whole thing. I mean, the man was governor of a state that includes black people, although he doesn't seem to understand that. And, you know, it's a remarkable kind of characterization of what the Civil War was about. You know, it's very much what we see coming out of the neo-Confederate hate groups that we cover as part of our work. You know, there's a long history that involves things like, you know, opposing redistricting that would have made it possible for a black representative to be elected from Virginia for the first time since Reconstruction. You know, joining and then unjoining, as it were, a club with a long racially exclusive history that many other governors had refused to join. And it goes on from there. I mean, he's very associated with the Confederate battle flag. I mean, as long ago as high school, he was wearing a pin in his lapel with this flag. And, you know, as has been widely reported, also had a flag at a certain cabin he had in Virginia, you know, which he describes as part of a collection of flags. You know, I just find the explanations, as you look at all this over time, you know, each one of his kind of quasi-apologies has been quite ridiculous, you know. As S.R. Siddharth just pointed out, I mean, the series of shifting explanations from his staff and from himself of this latest remark are incredible. I mean, I think on the face of it, it's virtually impossible to believe, you know, that somehow he made up a nickname or somehow this popped into his head. As Salon pointed out, you know, it was as if he were saying, you know, that he was speaking in tongues. This word had come to him somehow through the ether, and he was directing it at, you know, someone he perceived as his enemy.
On the issue of Dr. Martin Luther King's birthday?
Well, he was, of course, one of many Southern politicians who opposed Martin Luther King's birthday. I think one of the more remarkable things he said at the time was that he didn't want the holiday to be instituted because Martin Luther King was not a Virginian. You know, obviously, I think it hardly bears repeating that, you know, most other states in the Union have not felt that way at all. You know, the South as well, the North is filled with monuments and streets named after Martin Luther King and so on, and you don't hear that argument even in a place like Alabama. You know, the whole thing, at least to me, is reminiscent of the Trent Lott sort of series of fiascos of a few years ago. You know, I remember when Lott was exposed, actually, by us for having very close connections to the Council of Conservative Citizens, which is a white supremacist group, a descendant of the old white citizens' councils, and his series of shifting explanations. He had no idea who they were. Well, maybe he did. You know, and it went on and on and on until his relatives were quoted saying, actually, he was a longtime member. And, you know, in Lott's case, that didn't really come back to roost until he made his comments at Strom Thurmond's 100th birthday saying the Dixiecrats were right and so on, America would have been such a better place. You know, that whole story just reminds me of this episode. I think we're seeing the real George Allen. I think that this is not some, you know, freak moment. It's not a psychotic break. This is what the man really is.
I want to go back to S.R. Siddharth for final comment. The Albany Times Union has a column that says that it turns out the word macaca is a racist slur from Northern Africa used by those who would engage in that kind of racism. For example, French Tunisians, Alan's mother of French Tunisian descent, in no way suggesting she feels this way. But Salon.com also says in North Africa, the word macaca, often spelled macaco or macaque, is far more than a string of random syllables. According to the Oxford English Dictionary, the word dates back to the mid-1600s as a Flemish approximation of the Bantu word for monkey in the Congo and southern Gabon. Your final comment, and what is your demand right now? What are you asking of Senator Allen?
No, I think he should make a personal apology to me. That would be the decent thing for him to do. And I guess the point of this entire lesson, as Mr. Potok said, was just to show voters, you know, who the real George Allen is, and that this wasn't a one-time accident, that he has some history of doing this, and that people should be informed about that when come November.
And are you going to continue to follow Senator Allen with your video camera recording his events?
I'm actually back at school in Charlottesville, so for the moment, no, but I do plan to continue to work for Mr. Webb's campaign.
S.R. Siddharth, I want to thank you for being with us at the University of Virginia studios. And Mark Potok, thank you for joining us, Director of Intelligence Project for the Southern Poverty Law Center. And that does it for today's broadcast. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdelkaddous, John Hamilton, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Richin, Aaron Mate, Frank Lopez, and Jen Utes. Mike DeFilippo and Nick Marsilio are engineers. Thanks also to Hugh Grant, John Randolph, Peter Yoon, Kieran Krug-Meadows, Megan Whitney, Danielle Stramberg-Peshkin, Samantha Chambly, Angela Alston, and Uri Galed. Our website is democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.